I'm Tania Stewart, and you're listening to Swing Time from PRI, Public Radio International. Erskine Hawkins' Tuxedo Junction would become the theme song for the swing era. But before he became a band leader and composer, Erskine was a student musician just trying to keep the Depression from closing his school. And swing, the music that would define America for a whole generation, was being spread coast to coast by a bunch of talented, determined black kids.
When I heard Louis do the Shining, do these high C's on the end, and then I copied that.
Swing music was hot, but down in Birmingham, Alabama, young Erskine Hawkins was having trouble getting to hear it.
And I started listening to bands like Duke. They used to come to Birmingham to play one night stands. I used to step and climb the window to try to get in there. I was too young to go in to catch the band. And they influenced me a lot. He was one big band that I wanted to be. And Lou Armstrong. After I heard him coming out of New Orleans, man, I used to buy all his records.
The radio and records brought the world of swing to Birmingham via stations like WBRC and WKBC.
After Louis Armstrong, then I started listening to Jimmy Lunsford. See, I was still in school when Jimmy Lunsford got there, and so they used to do a lot of broadcasting out of the Cotton Club when they got there. And then from there, I started trying to get myself together.
But when the new danceable music came to Birmingham's black nightclubs, the place to hear it was Tuxedo Park. Crowds came to hear local groups like Fess Watley and his Jazz Demons, as well as big names like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington. And it was all happening near the trolley stop called Tuxedo Junction. First, the music was all about jazz. Musicologist Kip Lornell.
King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band that made recordings for Jeanette in 1923, but the first jazz recordings that had a great impact were Louis Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings, really in 1925, 1926, and 1927 for the OK Record Company.
But this was music made for dancing, and when the Savoy Ballroom opened in Harlem in 1926, it became a place where blacks and whites could come to enjoy the hottest music. And in 1934, the music found a new home when Harlem's Apollo Theater opened its doors to black audiences for the first time. Apollo Amateur Night launched the careers of Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday, and the Apollo's audiences became known as the world's toughest. From the Savoy, the Cotton Club, and the Apollo Swing, music swept the nation through radio programs with names like Let's Dance. But By the time Erskine Hawkins stood outside Birmingham's Elks Club listening to Duke Ellington, he was already a talented trumpet player whose powerful style had earned him the nickname Iron Lung. But when he got to Alabama State Teachers College, it was to play tennis, not music.
I got my scholarship at Alabama State playing tennis. I went to a relay at Tuskegee for Tuggle Institute. Mm-hmm. I was tennis. I was crazy about tennis.
But he was more interested in going to nightclubs than practicing his serve.
The door was locked at 11 o'clock. So only way we could get in, we had to go up the fire escape. So we go through the fire escape. So the dean got tired of us coming to the fire escape, so he knew who he was, so he just left the door open for us.
The dean wasn't just being nice. He was protecting an investment. The Depression had hit the state of Alabama hard when college president H. Council Trenum met with Governor Miller. He was told there was no money to keep his school open. But President Trenum had a great resource, the college's three popular dance bands. So he told band director William James to take the school bus and the Bama State Collegians and go earn money for the school. And in 1934, when Erskine Hawkins swapped his tennis racket for a trumpet and joined the Collegians, he became the top man in the top band. They joined bands from dozens of historically black colleges, including Tuskegee Institute, Grambling State, Howard University, Hampton Institute, and Morehouse. And they played the new music all over the country. Many musicians who started out as students would be recruited into the best dance orchestras of the day.
Trouble and you've got trouble, everybody's got some. When they trouble, you kick your troubles to kingdom come. Do you want to jump, children?
Historian Sherry Tucker says that it was no coincidence that young Americans started thinking of themselves in terms of the music. In fact, they were the focus of an intense and successful marketing campaign.
It became kind of a marketing label at a time when white bands were becoming the most famous. The swing era didn't mark the beginning of when swing music was played. It marked the beginning of the popularity and the financial rewards accrued by some of the by the white bands.
Erskine Hawkins and the Bama State Collegians were seeing some financial rewards themselves, but they didn't get to keep any. After their expenses were deducted, everything they earned went back to the school.
The hardest thing was going there and come back and try to get in class in the morning early. Then when we went out for the school, you know, they had tutors. Then we'd come back and still we get back at 8 o'clock, you got to go to class.
The Collegians served as a recruitment vehicle for Alabama State while raising money for the school. The band's earnings paid the teachers, paid the taxes, built the buildings, and kept the doors open. But all that was about to change.
I'm confessing that I love you. Tell me, do you love me? I'm confessing that I need you, honest I do.
New York never closed, especially up in Harlem. People closed down, finished having fun downtown. They used to come up to Harlem with their tuxedos on. And the bars, they stayed open 24 hours. And you walk around there hand in hand, it's like it's still daylight. And New York was beautiful.
And for Erskine Hawkins, New York was irresistible. He skipped out on the Collegians gig in New Jersey to play at the Apollo Theater in New York. Backstage, he was surprised by Louis Armstrong. Opportunity was about to knock. It was 1936 by the time the Collegians decided to turn pro, changing their name to the Erskine Hawkins Orchestra. They embarked on a recording career. Graduation day had come early. They never went back to school.
Once I left the school, you know, the president wasn't too happy about it, especially after the boys stayed with me, you know.
Right.
So a lot of things that I wanted to get for my credits and things,
yeah.
I never received them.
I wanted you mine, I gave you my line, you rose to my bait. Take heed to your fate, you can't escape from me.
Despite not getting to graduate, Erskine Hawkins found that his new life in the forefront of the swing phenomenon had plenty of compensation. By this time, an NBC announcer had given Erskine the nickname 20th Century Gabriel, and crowds were hanging on his every high note.
I remember one night when Benny Goodman and Chigwell had a battle of music, they called it. You couldn't get nowhere in that block. And now to show you how crowded it was, now I'm working that, I couldn't even get into him. I couldn't get through that front door. Now, that was a beautiful scene. You get up there and the people's always packed up there in front of the bandstand. And the Savoy Ballroom had a floor of what you call a swinging floor. And if people get in that groove, the band get in that groove, the people be going up and down. You can see that whole floor and crowd of people going up and down. That was a beautiful scene.
Swing music had gone mainstream. Kip Lornell.
When swing became the American popular music form, and that would be really true for the next 15 to 20 years, that white people were associated with African-American jazz forms. And really, it's Benny Goodman in 1935 who brought swing-oriented music into the national limelight. And he was able to do it for a couple reasons. Number one, he had a radio show on Saturday night on network radio that reached a lot of people, but also he was part of a tour that almost stalled and died in Denver. They decided to go on to the Palomar Ballroom in California, in Los Angeles. That particular event really was a pivotal event in swing because it introduced to a large audience in terms of very popular trends.
In 1939, Erskine Hawkins was at the peak of his popularity as a musician and composer. His biggest hit, the one that would become a theme song for America's GIs, nearly wrote itself.
When we went to record a session, that was in 1939, we was down to RCA Victor. The tune was finished there. They want to know what's my sixth tune was going to be. I said, give me a half an hour. So I took my rhythm section and went over to a corner, and I made up the introduction and finished out the first chorus. Music, in the beginning, wasn't even on paper. We did that from head to finish the whole tune. Once we finished the tune there, then I liked that beat and that sound after that. And then we named the tune after the tape was made.
In the year Tuxedo Junction was recorded, war broke out in Europe. And soon, for musicians and audiences alike, The threat of the draft loomed over the swing era. The black press issued a call to arms. If black Americans were going to fight fascism abroad, they would also fight racism at home. This was the Double V campaign, and it affected soldiers, war workers, and even musicians.
There was a cat out Chicago way, had a boogie style, no one else to play. He was the top man in his craft. Then his number came up, and he was gone to the draft. He's in the army now, blowing reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Historian Kenneth Jenkin.
Among the biggest efforts of the Double V campaign in its earliest stages was to modify the Selective Service Act to forbid discrimination in drafting.
For swing bands, the war years brought change and loss. Popular band leader Glenn Miller, whose cover of Tuxedo Junction had sold 115,000 copies in a single week, enlisted in the Army Air Corps and would vanish over the English Channel in December 1944. Downbeat magazine added a regular column entitled Killed in Action. And for Erskine Hawkins, the threat of the draft became real. One night, he noticed two unusual visitors in the audience. They weren't there to dance.
I said, "What's wrong? What's going on?" He said, "Your draft board been trying to get hold of you." And they said, "How long do you need?" I said, "About 6 months." My age was there. They hollered, "No, man, we can't give you that. Man, can't give you no 6 months. The war will be over by then." I get a wire from a draft board to not report until you hear from us.
His 30th birthday had come just in time to keep him out of the war. For college musicians, however, the draft ended their education along with their musical careers. And down in Texas at Prairie View College, the draft resulted in a radical change in the school band. Historian Sherry Tucker.
During the 1940s, when men were being drafted, Will Henry Bennett, who was the leader of the Prairie View Collegians, decided to try to keep a band going by having an all-women's band.
I'm Tania Stewart, and you're listening to Swing Time from PRI, Public Radio International. A band made up of women was not a new idea. In the 30s and 40s, there were literally hundreds of all-women bands touring the United States, and Prairie View had plenty of good women musicians. In fact, band director Bennett had tried adding female musicians to his dance band a few years earlier. Sherry Tucker.
He tried to add a woman to the band, but the dean of women wouldn't allow it.
But suddenly playing jazz became respectable. After all, there was a war on. By June of 1943, the Chicago Defender was profiling the Prairie View coeds under the heading Texas Gal Step Out in Music and predicting imminent stardom. But some parents were becoming concerned that their daughters were not exactly living up to their ideal of a college girl. Sherry Tucker.
Parents were very concerned about the women joining this band. One of the women that I talked to was actually pulled out of the band by her father, who went to hear a concert, and he was very shocked because of the repertoire included blues.
Aside from irate parents, band leader Will Henry Bennett faced the challenge of recruiting more professional players. If the coeds were going to break out of the routine of playing for Texas Army camps and go national, he needed experienced musicians. Just down the road in Denison, Texas, he found trumpeter Clara Bryant.
I'd gotten scholarships to Bennett College and Oberlin Conservatory, but that was classical music back there. So when they told me about this all-girl band at Prairie View, I knew that's where I was going to go.
If Clara Bryant had accepted that Oberlin scholarship, she would have been classically trained in the European musical tradition. As it was, she became a trumpeter with the coeds, playing all American music that was fast becoming a worldwide phenomenon.
What's a do?
The United States government's delivery of swing music to the troops and the fact that Hitler had banned jazz and swing helped define the music as patriotic. And the Prairie View coeds were in demand at dances and army camps throughout the South. But even though they were working for the war effort, the coeds faced the continual challenge of segregation. Clara Bryant.
We endured a lot of racial discrimination and stuff like that. When we pull into the service stations, you know, they would tell us that they didn't serve niggers, and they didn't bite their tongue by saying it.
Some of the prejudice the coeds experienced was coming from the audience. At times, their success depended on the ability to sound just like more famous male musicians.
We had a young lady in the band that played the trombone. She had a masculine voice, and there was a hit record on the radios and everything. The song was called Sweet Slumber, and this girl could sing it just like the man. Her voice was deep, you know, and she sounded just like the guy. She would break it up everywhere we went.
Some of Clara Bryant's popularity came from her ability to sound just like the popular white musician Harry James.
We played what they called at the time, they called them stock arrangements, where whatever record was hot, we'd buy the stock arrangement of that. And they always had the solo written note for note that was played on the record, because if you didn't play the solo like that in these clubs or at these dance halls, then you weren't playing the song. So we would play, I would have to learn the solos note for note, you know, and just like Tommy Dorsey said, well, get it. Charlie Shavers had a solo on there, it was really cutting, it was really hot, and I played that. That would be my good thing, and then the audience pleaser, you might call it, and also the Backbeat Boogie by Harry James.
She was so good at it that Backbeat Boogie became the co-ed's theme song. When they played for Soldiers, however, the co-eds knew they would be a hit. Margaret Grigsby recalled that at one stop, the soldiers were so happy that they nearly became casualties of war. She said, there were thousands of them, and we were up on the stage playing, and they were up in trees, and when we started playing, they turned loose and fell out of the trees. The black troops were not just happy to see pretty and respectable young women playing swing music. For many of them, the co-ed symbolized the Double V campaign against racism at home and fascism abroad. Sherry Tucker.
The black GIs, of course, were in segregated troops, and they often had white officers over those troops, and they were often denied all kinds of things that the white troops were able to get. The audience was not only thrilled for the music, and they were not just thrilled to see women, but they were thrilled to see, again, a glimpse of a different kind of society. One woman remembered soldiers yelling, "That's what I'm fighting for."
During the school year, the co-eds were students carrying their books to gigs, studying along the way, and recruiting new students for Prairie View. But during the summer, they were full-time professional musicians, and in the summer of 1944, they were headed straight for the top. New York's Apollo Theater. Clora Bryant.
When we reached Washington, D.C., the Gale Agency sent one of the agents down to frighten us and tell us about how they do you in New York at the Apollo. They would boo you and they would throw things at you, but we never experienced that. But he had us really frightened by the time we got to New York. But that was one of the big things for me, the summer of 44, playing the Apollo.
They had hit the big time. But the co-eds never forgot they were college girls. They even played for the Texas House of Representatives to get textbooks for their school. And their loyalty to Prairie View may have prevented them from becoming the best-known all-women swing band.
As the International Sweethearts of Rhythm laid on us with Diggin' Dyke! Dig!
That distinction would go to the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. They were a school band, but they weren't college girls. Sherry Tucker.
The International Sweethearts of Rhythm precedes the Prairie View Coeds, and while they're not connected with a college, they are connected with the history of black education, because they were students at Piney Woods Country Life School, which was a school more like a high school. Piney Woods Country Life School was founded to provide education for children who would not otherwise be able to have an education in Mississippi.
In 1937, when the band was formed, many of its members had never even seen a trombone. Yet in less than 4 years, this group of teenage girls would become a musical sensation, bringing their own style to the swing era. The name International Sweethearts began as a gimmick, but many members were of mixed racial heritage, and the band recruited musicians who fit the exotic image. 15-year-old Willie Mae Lee didn't even own a radio, but she looked Asian, so she was drafted into the Sweethearts and given a brand new last name. By the time she played baritone sax on this version of Witch Doctor, Willie Mae Wong was a seasoned performer. In Anderson, South Carolina, told her she sang just like Billie Holiday. But Evelyn McGee was not impressed. After all, she didn't even know who Billie Holiday was. But she did know a good party when she heard about one. So when she arrived at the Anderson Community Center dance in December 1939, she was ready for fun. And if she had on a radio, she would have realized she was about to meet America's number one all-girl band.
When you're feeling low and you don't know what to do. When you're feeling low and you don't know what to do. Just stay in the groove. Don't let nothing bother you.
Evelyn McGee Stone.
The International Sweethearts of Rhythm came to Anderson to play at the community center. At that time, that was the only place we blacks could go to have a, shall I say, a good time. The mortician of Anderson, South Carolina, one of them, Mr. Pete, W.I.G., asked the manager of the band if I could sing a couple of songs. And, of course, she agreed to let me sing, and they just loved what I did. Mrs. Jones asked Mr. Peake if he thought my mother would allow me to become the vocalist for this band. He didn't know whether or not my mother would allow me to become a member of this band. Of course, I cried and begged her, please let me go. And I didn't have a suitcase or anything. I just ran in the house and threw my stuff in a cardboard box. And I left Anderson that night with strangers. What can I say? I became an international sweetheart of rhythm that night.
Here once again are those 17 solid squares of glide and slide, the international sweethearts of rhythm. And they're going to slip the cellophane off the old Diddy Honeysuckle Rolls. So, gentlemen, latch the good ear on the fine tub thumping. Put out the one of Pauline Brady and you'll be rim-shot happy. Miss Winburn, hoist your baton and the fight is on.
The Sweethearts were in demand, and they were stars in the black press. The Chicago Defender called them a sensational mixed band, which is composed of Negroes, Mexicans, Chinese, and Indian girls. But their music was all American. It took them all the way to the 1939 World's Fair, where Evelyn McGee was a hit. The tune she sang was an old chestnut, but it had been given a swinging makeover.
I had never tried to sing Trees. That was not a jazz song, but I was asked to sing it, and I did. And oh, the applause, because they had an audience. And that is the first time that I realized that I had left Anderson, and here I'm singing in New York City at the World's Fair.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as the sea.
The World's Fair launched the Sweethearts into the upper echelon of swing society. And that meant the Apollo, Evelyn McGee Stone.
Breaking everybody's records. And that included Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Earl Hines. The Sweethearts of Rhythm were showstoppers, and they were lined up five abreast in front of these theaters to get in there.
Men, the International Sweethearts of Rhythm are going to cook a cantata with Pauline Brady banging those skin-covered kettles. Anna B. Winburn gives the downbeat, and we begin at the beginning of Lady Be Good.
For audiences, the Sweethearts represented a vision of the way the world should be. Thomas Jefferson Anderson, who heard them at the Howard Theater in 1940, later recalled what the experience meant to him. "Here I sat in a segregated audience and was witnessing a performance by women who looked like they were from all over the world. This was my first visual experience with integration. My glance into what the civil rights movement would be about approximately two decades later." But the Sweethearts were ready to revolt. They were making a lot of money, but getting to keep almost none of it. In April 1941, a better offer came along, and the Sweethearts were ready to listen. Helen Jones Woods.
"This young man had told us, if you come to Washington, you'll be able to have a good living and see the world."
So late one night, the Sweethearts decided to escape.
"In the middle of the night, when we played this dance at one of the dance halls down south, we decided we would leave, took the bus, and drove to Washington, D.C. They came for the instruments, but the girls wouldn't go back."
You're listening to Swing Time from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. The Sweethearts were professional musicians now and determined to be taken seriously. They hired the best arrangers and practiced long hours. Their new arranger, Maurice King, wrote music especially for them. Saxophonist Roz Krohn.
He wrote, if I remember, She's Crazy with the Heat, Five Vigor, Galvanizing. These are all originals. And Digging Dirt, Don't Get It Twisted. These are his originals, and they really swung. He showcased everybody to their best ability.
The Sweethearts were becoming a better band. They were also venturing into new territory and straight into conflict with the era's racial laws. The Sweethearts didn't get their first white member until 1943, and even then it was an accident. Toby Butler, an orphan, had been raised by a black family, and when she became a Sweetheart, the band became her family. Later she recalled, "We knew no color. We did not know white, black, red, or yellow. It didn't matter. We just knew each other and the love of music." The Sweethearts may not have thought color mattered, but the rest of the world did. After the band added red-headed Boston saxophonist Roz Krohn, they headed south to the domain of Jim Crow, the segregation laws. Roz found herself in the unusual position of having to pass for black to keep from being arrested.
I was very fair. So was Toby. Toby had grown up in the black community. So even though she was quite fair, she never seemed to have any problem. I was playing saxophone right in front. Maybe that's why it was easier to spot. We tried different perms and different makeups, and it didn't work. When they made the move, I simply disappeared along with two other light-skinned girls who were black. And we ran away, ran out of town, or whatever we had to do, we did.
Throughout their popular Southern tours, the Sweethearts were ready to run. As Toby Butler said, "When you were told to get out of town in 15 minutes, you were out of town in 15 minutes. The whole bus, the whole band, everything." Partly because of their struggles with segregation, the Sweethearts were heroines in the black press. But the papers didn't know that the band members were still being exploited. At their peak, they earned $45 a week, and some of that was skimmed off by their manager. But the Sweethearts were headed for the top. Led by Vi Burnside's powerful saxophone, they traveled the country, playing in battle of band shows until they reached the Apollo Theater.
On my left are the Sweethearts of Rhythm, one of America's top all-girl bands, directed by Anna Mae Winburn. Jack, they are ready. And on my right, our own Armed Force Radio Orchestra, solid singers from the finest bands in the land. Jack, they can't wait. 36 solid gold give artists, boys and girls, to lift you right out of this cosmos. Are you ready, boys?
Yeah!
Are you ready, girls?
Yeah!
Gentlemen of the righteous jive, we give you Jubilee's Philharmonic and Double Symphonic version of Count Basie's 1 o'clock jump.
They were a hit. they were accepted as professional musicians, and then they were off to see the world. It was a world torn by war. Black GIs who heard them play Tuxedo Junction on the Armed Forces Radio's Jubilee programs mounted a letter-writing campaign. And in 1945, the Sweethearts became the first black women musicians to travel to Europe with the USO. "We broke it up over there," said Evelyn McGee Stone. "The GIs just went wild. And it wasn't just because we were women." At one show, the GIs were wowed by Pauline Braddy's drum solo on Lady Be Good. But the most interesting part of the performance may have been pianist Johnny Mae Rice's piano solo. The tinkly little riff, which had been part of the black band's repertoire for years, became Dizzy Gillespie's bebop anthem, Salt Peanuts.
Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts. Salt peanuts, salt peanuts.
The music and the world was changing. Erskine Hawkins, who had left Alabama State Teachers College without graduating, found himself being made an honorary Ph.D. by his forgiving alma mater. Swing was becoming respectable just as the swing era made way for new music.
The next big thing in jazz was really bebop. And one of the things that occurred during bebop, we're talking here about mid-1940s, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis. This was really a revolution against swing. It was really black American jazz musicians reclaiming their musical heritage.
Kip Lornell.
They created music that you couldn't dance to. They created music that was more harmonically expansive. And even though they still built on blues, as so many of Charlie Parker's tunes did, they were trying to reclaim music for themselves.
Bebop, which prided itself on not being danceable, became a major part of the jazz scene. The war was over, the baby boom was just beginning, and Americans were being told to stay home with the kids. Women musicians found jobs becoming scarce as male musicians returned from the war and flooded the shrinking market. Sherry Tucker.
It's very expensive to book big bands, and at the end of the war, the economy is changing. People are encouraged to stay home, and there are fewer opportunities for big bands to play. And so the big bands, male and female, black and white, a lot of them have combos that are coming out of them, smaller groups that are becoming very popular.
Former co-ed Clora Bryant found her musical home in Los Angeles on vibrant post-war Central Avenue.
I felt so good because I was on Central Avenue and the black people were so together. I mean, the men were sharp with their suits and the ties and the shirt and the shoes shined and the hats and the ladies and their gloves. And, you know, it was just, it's something to see all those people, all of my people, looking like that and having a good time and up and down the streets and in and out of the clubs. I was too young to go into the clubs, but my brother would let me stand outside and listen. And that's where I first heard Roy Porter and all those guys. And then every night in December when Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker came to California, played Billy Berg's out in Hollywood. They had a radio broadcast, so I was able to hear them. You know, it was just like being live. That was thrilling. I'm getting goosebumps.
Determination paid off. In 1957, Clora Bryant recorded her first album, Gal with a Horn. The International Sweethearts of Rhythm were left out of the official history of jazz, and most of them didn't have the option of pursuing a professional career outside music. Sherry Tucker.
The women who played with the Sweethearts, the core members were primarily quite poor. They had gone to this school which was primarily for poor black children, and so they had lived at the school, and so the core members, they were also professional members who were older and who were not a part of the school, but the core members had been really deceived by the professional bookers.
The worst came when the former Sweethearts tried to apply for Social Security and found the manager had pocketed their deductions. Evelyn McGee Stone remembered. They earn an awful lot of money off the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. When we became older and applied for Social Security, it was deducted from our little salary, but it was never turned in, and that was heartbreaking. Erskine Hawkins didn't face the same sort of challenges as the women musicians, but though his popularity allowed him to negotiate the changes in the music and in American life with aplomb, he still had to adjust.
I was one of the last bands to break down, besides Duke and Count. I brought it first down to 10, and then from there, the next time, I think I had it down to 7. Mm-hmm. And then finally, just a little before I came in here, I went to a quartet.
But he settled into a long career with his smaller band, bringing swing to the Catskills at the Concord Hotel. Some former swing band members continued to influence American music by going into education. Their contributions were recognized when the Prairie View Coeds reunited at Prairie View in 2002. Clora Bryant, still playing professionally, found herself overwhelmed by memories.
The reunion and to see those ladies again, it was just, you know, it was crying time. We had a lot of handkerchiefs out.
When you're feeling low and you don't know what to do. When you're feeling low and you don't know what to do. Just in the groove. Don't let nothing bother you.
They had been left out of the history books. But in the 1980s, the International Sweethearts of Rhythm were rediscovered through recordings of their wartime Jubilee broadcast. To audiences who didn't know how the Sweethearts had been exploited, their rags-to-riches story sounded like Cinderella without the prince. Sherry Tucker.
Both audiences were interested in this international theme. The audiences in the 40s were interested in the international theme for the reasons that I've mentioned already, because it was a powerful theme for segregated black audiences to look at black internationalism. And for the 80s audiences, and this is a very specific audience in the 80s that I'm talking about, which would be an audience associated with the second wave of the women's liberation movement, an image of women working together across difference, which was something that the women's movement at that time was working on and something that feminists are still working on.
They may have been just a bunch of students, but when the black school bands went on the road, their swinging music kept the school doors open, helped pull the country out of depression, and came to symbolize America. And what fun they had doing it. Swing Time was produced by Artemis Media Project. Executive producer, Kathy Farnell. Production assistant by Alabama Public Television and Adam Vincent. We had additional assistance from Chris Roos and Nomad Productions. This project is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by a grant from the Alabama State Council on the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Our thanks to the interviewees who gave us their time, particularly Dr. Kip Lornell, Dr. Sherry Tucker, Dr. Kenneth Jenkin, Clora Bryant, Isola Thetford Collins, Ernie Mae Crofton Miller, Roz Crone, Helen Cole, Evelyn McGee Stone. Thanks to Riverwalk Jazz for permission to excerpt material from their interview with Helen Jones Woods. Thanks also to Dan Morgenstern and the Institute of Jazz Studies, Rutgers University, for permission to excerpt material from archival interviews with Erskine Hawkins. And to Dr. Sherry Tucker for permission to excerpt material from her book, Swing Shift. This program is dedicated to the memory of Dr. Jean Schaefer. Find more about black college swing bands at www.swingtimepublicradio.org. I'm Tania Stewart.
PRI, Public Radio International.